So I just want to take a quick moment to welcome you here this morning and to start by saying it's great to have a week, you know, where I get to work a football story in. So if you're here and you are, and you're not a fan of football, then I'm glad you're here and welcome. And it's great to have you here. And if you're here and you're like kind of a fan of football, like you would identify a team, of football that you like, but you don't really know, you know, anything about the game. You don't really care to actually watch the games. You don't have, you know, anything like that going on. Then I'm glad that you're here. And if you're in either of those camps, then I'll ask for an apology, as we begin this morning, because we're going to start with kind of a little bit of a football story, as we kick off here. And if you didn't guess, I like the Pittsburgh Steelers. I would say I even love the Pittsburgh Steelers, and that I have for for a long time. And there's something that goes along with being a fan of the Pittsburgh Steelers, and that is that there's kind of like an equally, you know, a proportionate dislike for other teams in the NFL. And one of those teams would be the Baltimore Ravens. So I would say if you're a person who would say you like the Steelers, then you would dislike the Ravens. And if you're a person who would say you love the Steelers, then I would say you hate the Ravens. And that's kind of the way that it shakes out. And the feeling is 100% mutual. You'd like to think you could move beyond that, but it was even, there's kind of a funny story where last year when I started here, it was late September, I went to like the first district pastors kind of get together, and the first night there I ended up at dinner sitting beside a Baltimore Ravens fan, and we were like talking a little bit, and we're like very pleasant, and you know, it was like nice, it was, you know, a pastor's kind of conference, and then he asked to be my friend on Facebook, and so we were like Facebook friends, and then it was like a week or 2 weeks later, and like every day he's posting something about how much he hates the Steelers and loves the Ravens and things like that, and I thought, I'll just defriend him. I'll block him. I don't need any more friends in my life. So that, at least any that are Ravens fans. So just kidding if you're a Ravens fan here, but that was all true. So that's why I begin by saying this. It pains me to tell the story I'm about to tell you this morning. But it's a story from the 2012 NFL season, and it's not about the Steelers at all, but it's about the Denver Broncos. And so something happened in the offseason before the 2012 season, and that was that the Denver Broncos signed Peyton Manning to their team. And if you know the whole situation, he, you know, one of the greatest quarterbacks to ever play the game. At the time, at the height of his career, arguably the best quarterback on the field, struggled in the postseason, but set all kinds of records, was this incredible athlete, changed the way that people played the quarterback position. And then he had a season, not just a season-ending injury that was kind of mid-season, but he had to have several surgeries done that put him out of football for an entire year. So the team he played for almost his entire year career, the Indianapolis Colts, they let him go. And in the offseason, he was probably the most sought-after free agent. You know, certainly, you know, in the last 20 years, but one of probably the most sought-after free agents of all time. Anybody who didn't have one of the top four or five quarterbacks in the NFL would have gladly signed Peyton Manning. And so in the offseason, the Denver Broncos, they kind of won that contest. They wooed Peyton Manning to Denver. And it was a kind of a rocky start for them as that season began to unfold. So they started with losing three of their first five games. And so it was kind of like things weren't really meshing well on offense. They had a really good defense that was kind of carrying them a little bit. And then all of a sudden, they ripped off 11 straight wins to end the season. Peyton Manning set a bunch of records again. The passing offense was incredible. There was all this kind of all this acknowledgement that Peyton Manning's back. He was comeback player of the year. He was runner-up for MVP. He was getting all of these accolades left and right. And they go into the postseason as the number one team in the AFC, and so a heavy favorite to play in the Super Bowl. They had home field advantage through the playoffs and all of that. And then in their first playoff game, they had a first week bye in the playoffs. In their first playoff game in the divisional round, they went up against the Baltimore Ravens. And the Ravens were not as good as the Broncos. They were kind of a team that had a good defense. They've always kind of had a good defense. They were opportunistic on offense, but they weren't. They didn't have nearly the kind of the skill, the pedigree, the offensive kind of power and abilities that the Denver Broncos had. But they went into Denver and they like played a classic NFL game that went to two overtimes, and it came out that the Ravens won the game and would eventually go on to win the Super Bowl that year, and that's the painful part for me to acknowledge. But in the aftermath of the game, and hindsight's always 20/20, people began to pick apart, how did the Broncos, who were so good, lose to the Ravens, who were just clearly not as good of a team? And there were a few key moments in the game that people look to. One was this, was that with a tie game almost going into halftime, 36 seconds left, the Broncos had the ball in good field position with three timeouts left. So plenty of time for one of the best quarterbacks of all time to ever play the game to scoot you 20 yards, 30 yards down the field to try to kick a field goal. And this is the playoffs. So maybe in the regular season, maybe in preseason, you don't take a chance. You take a knee, you go into halftime tied, and you kind of regroup. But that's what the Broncos chose to do in the playoffs. In a game where if you lose, your season's over. With three timeouts left and the best quarterback that year, the best quarterback, one of the best quarterbacks ever, they take a knee and they go into halftime and leave it as a tied game. And then if that wasn't enough, so it comes out in the second half, and the defenses didn't play well. It's going back and forth with the offense. It's kind of this like slugfest happening, lots of touchdowns being scored. So with 2 minutes left in the game, the Broncos have a 7-point lead, so the game is tight, and they're faced with this situation where they have a 3rd and 7 with 2 minutes left, and if they get one more first down, the game is over. And in that situation, instead of allowing one of the best quarterbacks of all time to throw a 7-yard pass and trust that he doesn't throw an interception, they run the ball. They don't go for a first down. They want to run the clock down and hopefully end the game. So they don't try to ice the kick themselves. They just try to make sure that they don't make a mistake that opens the door for the Ravens. But they didn't get the first down. The Ravens get the ball back. The Ravens go down the field and they score. And so with 31 seconds left in the game, it is a tie game. If you win, you go on, and if you lose, your season's over. And the Broncos come out with one of the best quarterbacks, like a broken record, one of the best quarterbacks to ever play the game, two timeouts left, in good field position. And instead of trying to get close enough to kick a long field goal in a mile-high stadium where you can kick them far, they take a kneel, and they send the game to overtime. They didn't even try to do it. They just played it as safe as they possibly could. So it goes into overtime. Eventually it goes into double overtime. And the opportunistic Ravens, who are literally just chucking the ball down the field every chance they get, find a way to win the game. And so the Broncos did everything that they could throughout that game. This is kind of what it came down to play, not to lose the game. At every moment, they kind of played the odds of the situation. So we have a 7-point lead. There's not much time left. If we can just run a little bit of time off the clock and let our defense handle it, we should be okay. Or, that we're in our own side of the field. If we just kneel the ball right now and go into halftime, we'll get a shot. We'll come back out. Hopefully we'll be okay. They did the safest move they could in every situation. And as a result of doing that, what happened was that they just spent the whole game playing not to lose. And in doing so, they never really gave themselves an opportunity to win that game. They never risked it for the win. They just played it safe and they lost. And the reason why I tell that story is certainly not because I like remembering the Ravens winning the Super Bowl. And I like the Broncos. I don't like thinking about them losing. It's because for so many of us in life, over and over again, we find ourselves in situations where we are only playing not to lose. We find ourselves in situations all the time where we're spending the majority of our lives trying as hard as we can not to lose. You know, so sometimes for us, we spend so much time focusing on making sure that we don't offend others, that we don't say things that maybe we should say. Sometimes we spend so much time, and lots of people do this, where we are always preparing for the worst or worrying about the worst outcome that can come in a situation that we don't even focus in on the good in situations. Sometimes for us, we spend so much time playing it safe in life, in all kinds of different areas of life. Or we try to kind of stick to things that are our tried and true way of doing things. We settle in to our routine in the way that things should be done, that we never really risk it to try something that's new or something that might be difficult for us. And I would say, let's take a quick moment for all of us, myself included, to kind of think of how we might answer some of these questions to identify if we live this way. Are you the kind of person who always plays it safe or plays not to lose in regards to your job? You know, you're the kind of person, you show up, you punch your time card, or, you know, a lot of us don't actually punch time cards, but you show up to work every day, you do what's expected of you, but the last thing you want to be is noticed. You know, you never really try too hard or push too hard or invest yourself too much into your work because you don't want to stand out. You try not to do anything bad that would make you stand out. You just want to do whatever you can to kind of be safe, fly beneath the radar, and just kind of be in a position where you're comfortable, in a position where you feel like there's nothing I can do that can lose here. Or you're in that kind of a position. Are you the kind of person that walks on eggshells all the time, not really sure what to say because you don't want to say the wrong thing that might make you look, less important, less intelligent, less cool. You don't want to offend other people. You don't want to kind of say anything else. You're always reading the room to see what other people think before you speak. You're always kind of playing it safe and never really putting yourself out there. Are you the kind of person that avoids new experiences like the plague? A lot of us kind of find ourselves in positions like that, where we're afraid to try something new or to risk something because we're afraid that we might fail if we do. We're afraid to put ourselves out there in some kind of way because we don't want to have that, we don't want to go through that process of saying, maybe I made a mistake, maybe I should have done this differently. We don't want to look silly in front of other people. Any of those kinds of things. Are you that kind of person? I know that sometimes I could answer all of those questions yes. You know, I'm sure for some of us, we find ourselves in situations on a regular basis where we're simply kind of going through life and we're playing not to lose. And the problem with that situation is that every time we are playing not to lose, we are allowing the fear of failure to control how we act. We allow the fear of failure to control how we live. When we're afraid to take a risk, to step out, to do something differently, to put ourselves out there, for lots of us, we don't do that because we think it's a bad decision. We do that because we're afraid that we might mess up, that we might fail in any given situation. And when we devote all of our time to making sure that we don't lose, what we lose sight of is the fact that we have no reason to fear failure. That the message of Scripture is clear. That if we are in Christ, that there is no reason for us to fear failing in this life. And one of the main places where we see this kind of played out in Scriptures in 1 John chapter 5. And so we're going to look a little bit at this short letter today and at this short passage. And before we look into that, there are two main reasons why this letter was written. So this wasn't written to a specific church. This wasn't written to a specific group of Christians. 1 John is kind of one of the broader, larger books. So it's written to Christians kind of spread all throughout a given area. And one of the main reasons why John writes to them is to say, hey, you really are Christians and you really have experienced salvation. And that seems a little bit strange for us, especially for people maybe who have been Christians for a long time. But one of the main reasons he writes to them is simply to assure them of the salvation they've experienced. And if you think about the situation of the church at the time, it makes a lot of sense, really. So 1 John's written, they think, like between, you know, AD 90 and 95. So this is like 60 years after Jesus was on the earth. And so Jesus has just kind of left. The gospel is spreading out through the region, and it's been spreading for 60 years. So in this group of Christians that John's writing to, you might have some second generation Christians, some people who grew up and their parents were believers. But you have a whole lot of people who are really young and immature and don't know much about the faith that they're kind of exploring at this time. And so John writes to them in some ways just to be able to clear a few things up for them. And one of the most important pieces is that he wants to say to them, you really have, if you've placed your faith in Jesus Christ, it really is that easy. It really is that clear cut. And when you experience forgiveness, you've experienced new life. So that's kind of a big piece of what John is telling them. And then one of the other pieces is that he's writing to warn them about some false teachings that were taking place in the area. And it's similar, but the opposite of a false teaching that we kind of hear all the time today. And so the way it played out was that people in that time, in that region, they could look back at Jesus. And it's a pretty fresh picture, looking back at Jesus. And they could understand the things that he had done and see the things that he had done. And what they said was, we can acknowledge and accept and believe that Jesus is God. But what we can't acknowledge or accept or believe is that Jesus was a man. That Jesus was a human. So they would recognize the deity of Christ, but they believed that no deity would kind of tie itself to the humanity of Jesus. And they would look back at the historical things that he had done and say, there's no way that he was a human. Now, for us, lots of times we've kind of flipped that exact circumstance where lots of people today look back and they can see and believe and accept a historical Jesus, but they say, sure, we can understand there was a guy who was born to Mary and Joseph. There was a guy who taught people. There's a guy who treated people nicely, who did really good things for people. But we don't acknowledge the deity that he experiences. And so one of the, in the flesh, and one of the main pieces that John writes is to say, as strange as this is, that Jesus is 100% man, human, born of the Virgin Mary. And at the same time, 100% deity. The math doesn't work out in that, and it's strange. And so as a result, people try to find all these ways to explain it. But John writes to them to say, this is the reality of the situation. And so going from there, we're going to look at 1 John chapter 5, starting in verse 1. It says, everyone who believes that Jesus is the Christ is born of God. And everyone who loves the Father loves his child as well. This is how we know that we love the children of God, by loving God and carrying out his commands. In fact, this is love for God, to keep his commands. And so we'll take a break here for a minute. This is the point where lots of people struggle with faith. And, you know, they think it's kind of like a bait and switch, you know, where, hey, I understand I need redemption. I know I'm kind of messed up in life. I need to experience freedom from sin and death and all those things. So I accept Jesus. And then people are afraid once I do that, there's all these other rules and things that I have to follow. And that's a real fear that people have today. And it's a fear that people had then too, apparently, because John follows that up by saying, in fact, this is love for God, to keep his commands, and his commands are not burdensome. For everyone born of God overcomes the world. This is the victory that has overcome the world, even our faith. And so in this passage, it really begins. It says commands a lot and talks about faithfulness to God. A lot of it's really talking about the fellowship of believers and taking care of each other and how that's one of those commands. But it summarizes it in verse 5 by saying this. Who is it that overcomes the world? Only the one who believes that Jesus is the Son of God. And so that's how John kind of summarizes this passage for us, that regardless of what we experience in the world, the commands that Jesus lays on us, they're not the things that are burdensome. They're not the things that we need to overcome. He says, it's all of these other things that life lays on us. It's all of the kind of the worry, the anxiety, the playing it safe, all of the different circumstances that we experience in life and these struggles, these are the things that we need to overcome. The commands of Jesus aren't burdensome. They're what give us life. The commands to love each other, to take care of each other, to live righteously, they aren't the things that create burdens. It's the patterns of the world that put these heavy burdens onto us. And so he says, who is it that can overcome those burdens that the world places on us? It's only people who believe in Jesus. One of the other places where this is most clear in Scripture comes in Romans chapter 8. And in that letter, Paul is writing to a specific group of Christians, and they are Christians who experience persecution and torment and difficulties as a result of their faith like we have no idea today. And so he writes to these people, and in Romans 8, he talks a lot about the present sufferings that the people are experiencing and how it's in these times, you know, that the Spirit of God is with us and allows us to continue on in our faith. And then in Romans chapter 8, verse 31, he writes this, and this is kind of response. He says, "What then shall we say in response to these things?" It's not kind of response. He says it right there. It is a response. And the things he's talking about are the problems that we experience in this life. "What then shall we say in response to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us?" And just a few verses later, in verses 37 and 38, he says, "No, in all these things, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I am convinced that neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, neither the present nor the future, nor any powers, neither height nor depth, nor anything else in all creation, nothing in creation will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus our Lord." Paul makes it really clear in the book of Romans that whatever we experience in this life, we don't need to shrink back in fear because of the situations that we encounter, because it is through Jesus and through a love that he has for us that cannot be overcome by anything that we experience in life. It's through that love that we are described as more than conquerors. We're not people who are called to play life, not to lose. We're not people who are called to shrink back in situations. We're called to be people who are more than conquerors. People who are connected with God the Father through the work of Jesus Christ. And the truth is that there is one thing that always accompanies playing to win in a game. And that is playing with risk. It's the idea for, it's the idea in a literal game, like a football, where you're not just shrinking back and playing not to lose. You're not always taking the safest step. You're not always playing the odds. You're going out at some point and you have to decide, we're not just going to try not to lose this game, but we're going to try to win this game. It seems like a funny thing that you even have to lay that out when it comes to a game. But in life, we do that all the time, where we just kind of try to bob through life and not lose and do whatever we can not to lose. But if we're going to be people that live faithfully, it will always mean for us taking faith-filled risks on behalf of our faith. And I'm not saying that we should be people who make stupid decisions. I'm not saying that we should be people who say everything that pops into our mind or who do everything that pops into our mind. I'm not saying that we should be people who just play life kind of fast and loose like there aren't any consequences. I'm not saying anything like that or anything close to that. But if we're going to be people who live faithfully, then we need to be people who are willing to take risks when God places opportunities in front of us. The most common stories about this in Matthew chapter 14 is when Peter steps out of the boat. And so the disciples are in the boat. Jesus has kind of sent them up ahead of him. And then it's this, strange circumstance where Jesus is walking out onto the water to them. And Peter says, "Lord, if that's you, call me out on the water." And Jesus does that. And Peter has enough faith and is presented with an opportunity to step into that faith that he walks off of the boat and walks onto the water. And if you know the story, you know that he takes a few steps on the water, or he's out on the water. And what is it that begins to hinder him? He looks around and he's afraid. He's afraid of losing. He's afraid because he realizes he's kind of outpunted his coverage. He's afraid because he realizes he's out beyond what he can control. He's out beyond what's safe and what's easy and what isn't risky for him. And he becomes afraid and he begins to sink and he needs Jesus. And for us this morning, I would encourage you to be like Peter in both ends of that story. In the beginning of the story, when he's able to see an opportunity that God places in front of him, and in faith, he risks it and he steps out and he follows God. And then in the inevitability, when we fear in life, I would encourage you to be people that don't just sink into your fear, but call out to Jesus for the help that you need. Because as Christians and as people who should be Christians, you know, as people who have grace and love from Jesus extended to us, we aren't called to be people who shrink back in fear. We're people who should win in life. We're people who should really see ourselves as more than conquerors when situations are presented to us that are really difficult and situations that are hard. There's a quote from a brand new book by Mark Batterson, and in it, he says this. He says, at the end of our lives, the greatest regrets will be the God-ordained opportunities we left on the table. And you know, for each of us, that looks differently. Sometimes we have these God-ordained opportunities to take a risk in little, simple, kind of easy ways. You know, it's helping someone out who's in need. It's giving a hand to a neighbor who you see who's working on a project. It's saying a kind word to someone who looks like they need it. And sometimes it's a bigger risk. Sometimes for people, it's sharing about your faith. It's going on a missions trip. It's doing something like that that you're really not comfortable with, but you feel like God's given you the opportunity to do that. May we be a people that don't leave opportunities on the table. You know, may we be the kind of people who follow God faithfully when he presents us with a chance, and who don't kind of shrink back, who don't fear. I'm going to really struggle to say that. May we be people who are bold and who take risks, who are brave enough to step into something when we're presented with an opportunity and don't shrink back in fear. I'd encourage you to think about your life and to think about the ways that God is giving you an opportunity right now to step out in faith. About the opportunities that you're presented with every day to step out and to serve God. And the risks that are associated with that. Because when we think about this reality, that we don't have to worry about the fear of failure, because God's commands aren't burdensome, because he's promised that we overcome the world, because he said that we are more than conquerors, then it makes kinds of those fears that we have seem less significant. So I'd encourage you to think about some of those fears that you have and some of those opportunities that you have to serve him.